brook this whole time. It felt simultaneously very hot and very cold. And he had the strange fear that if he touched it for a moment longer, it might erode a hole through his palm. He held it out. "Here, sir. Keep it," said Professor Lovell. "Sir?"
"I have been staring at that bar every day for the past 5 years, wondering where I went wrong with Griffin. If I had raised him differently or seen him earlier for what he was, if Evie would still... But never mind."
Professor Lovell's voice hardened.
"Now it weighs on your conscience. Keep it, Robin Swift. Carry it in your front pocket. Pull it out whenever you begin to doubt and let it remind you which side are the villains."
He motioned for Robin to leave the office. Robin stumbled down the stairs, the silver clutched tight in his fingers, dazed and quite sure he'd pushed his entire world off course. Only he hadn't the faintest clue whether he'd done the right thing, what right and wrong meant at all, or how the pieces might now fall. Interlude. Rami. Ramiz Rafi Mirza had always been a clever boy. He had a prodigious memory, the gift of the gab. He soaked up languages like a sponge, and he had an uncanny ear for rhythm and sound. He did not merely repeat the phrases he absorbed, he uttered them in such precise imitation of the original speaker, investing his words with all their intended emotion, it was like he momentarily became them. In another life, he would have been destined for the stage. He had that ineffable skill of making simple words sing. Rami was brilliant, and he had ample opportunity to show off. The Mirza family had navigated the vicissitudes of that era with great fortune. Although they were among the Muslim families who had lost land and holdings after the permanent settlement, the Mirzas had found steady, if not very lucrative, employment in the household of one Mr. Horace Hayman Wilson, secretary of the Asiatic Society of Bengal in Calcutta. Sir Horace had a keen interest in Indian languages and literatures, and he took great delight in conversing with Rami's father, who had been well educated in Arabic, Persian, and Urdu. So Rami grew up among the elite English families of Calcutta's White Town, among porticoed and colonnaded houses built in European styles and shops catering exclusively to a European clientele. Wilson took an early interest in his education, and while other boys his age were still playing in the streets, Rami was auditing classes at the Mohammedan College of Calcutta, where he learned arithmetic, theology, and philosophy. Arabic, Persian, and Urdu he studied with his father. Latin and Greek he learned from tutors hired by Wilson. English he absorbed from the world around him. In the Wilson household, they called him the little professor. Blessed Rami. Dazzling Rami. He had no idea what the purpose was of anything he studied, only that it delighted the adults so when he mastered it all. Often, he performed tricks for the guests Sir Horace had over to his sitting room. They would show him a series of playing cards, and he'd repeat with perfect accuracy the suit and number of the cards in the order in which they'd appeared. They would read out whole passages or poems in Spanish or Italian, and he, not understanding a word of what was said, would recite it back, intonations and all. He once took pride in this. He liked hearing the guests' shouts of wonder, liked the way they ruffled his hair and pressed sweets into his palm before they bade him scamper off to the kitchens. He had no understanding of class then, or of race. He thought it was all a game. He did not see his father watching from around the corner, eyebrows knitted with worry. He did not know that impressing a white man could be as dangerous as provoking one. One afternoon when he was 12 years old, Wilson's guest summoned him during a heated debate.
"Rami?"
The man who waved him over was Mr. Trevelyan, a frequent visitor, a man with prodigious sideburns and a dry, wolf-like smile.
"Come here." "Oh, leave him be," said Sir Horace. "I'm proving a point."
Mr. Trevelyan beckoned with one hand.
"Rami, if you please."
Sir Horace did not tell Rami not to. So Rami hurried to Mr. Trevelyan's side and stood straight, hands clasped behind his back like a little soldier. He'd learned that English guests adored this stance. They found it precious.
"Yes, sir?"
Count to 10 in English, said Mr. Trevelyan. Rami obliged. Mr. Trevelyan knew perfectly well he could do this. The performance was for the other gentlemen present.
Now in Latin, said Mr. Trevelyan.
And when Rami had accomplished that,
now in Greek.
Rami complied. Gratified chuckles around the room, Rami decided to test his luck. Little numbers are for little children, he said in perfect English. If you'd like to converse about algebra, pick a language and we'll do that too. Charmed chuckles. Rami grinned, rocking back and forth on his feet, waiting for the inevitable press of candy or coin. Mr. Trevelyan turned back to the other guests.
Consider this boy and his father. Both of similar ability, both of a similar background and education. The father begins with even more of an advantage, I would say, as his father, I'm told, belonged to a wealthier merchant class. But so fortunes rise and fall. Despite his natural talents, Mr. Mirza here can attain no better than a posting as a domestic servant. Don't you agree, Mr. Mirza?
Rami saw the most peculiar expression then on his father's face. He looked as if he were holding something in, as if he'd swallowed a very bitter seed but was unable to spit it out. Suddenly, this game did not seem such fun. He felt nervous now for showing off, but couldn't quite put his finger on why.
Come now, Mr. Mirza, said Mr. Trevelyan. You can't claim that you wanted to be a footman.
Mr. Mirza gave a nervous chuckle.
It's a great honour to serve Sir Horace Wilson.
Oh, come off it. No need to be polite. We all know how he farts.
Rami stared at his father. The man he still thought was as tall as a mountain. The man who had taught him all his scripts. Roman, Arabic,
and Nastalich.
The man who taught him Salah. The man who taught him the meaning of respect. His Hafiz. Mr. Mirza nodded and smiled.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Trevelyan, sir. Of course, I'd rather be in your position.
Oh, there you go, said Mr. Trevelyan. You see, Horace, these people have ambitions. They have the intellect and the desire to self-govern, as so they should.
Rami was, though he did not know it, then at the centre of a debate between the Orientalists, including Sir Horace Wilson, who favoured teaching Sanskrit and Arabic to Indian students, and the Anglicists, including Mr. Trevelyan, who believed Indian students of promise ought to be taught English. This debate would come down firmly on the side of the Anglicists, best represented by Lord Thomas Macaulay's infamous February 1835 Minute on Education. We must at present do our best to form a class who may be interpreters between us and the millions whom we govern, a class of persons Indian in blood and colour, but English in tastes, in opinions, in morals, and in intellect.
And it's your educational policies that are keeping them down. India simply has no languages for statecraft. Your poems and epics are all very interesting, to be sure, but on the matters of administration...
The room exploded again into clamorous debate. Rami was forgotten. He glanced at Wilson, still hoping for his reward, but his father cast him a sharp look and shook his head. Rami was a clever boy. He knew to make himself scarce. 2 years later, in 1833, Sir Horace Wilson left Calcutta to take on the position of the first chair of Sanskrit at Oxford University.
Wilson's election to this position had raised something of a controversy. He had been in heated competition with Reverend W.H. Mill for election, and Reverend Mill's supporters spread the rumour that Wilson had insufficient character for the job, as he had 8 illegitimate children. Wilson's supporters defended him on the grounds that, in fact, he had only 2.
Mr. and Mrs. Mirza knew better than to protest when Wilson proposed to bring their son with him to England, and Rami did not begrudge his parents for not fighting to keep him at their side. He knew, by then, how dangerous it was to defy a white man.
My staff will raise him up in Yorkshire, Wilson explained. I will visit him when I can take leave from the university. Then, when he's grown, I'll have him enrolled at University College. Charles Trevelyan might be right, and English might be the path forward for the natives. But there's value yet in Indian languages where scholars are concerned. English is good enough for those chaps in civil administration. But we need our real geniuses studying Persian and Arabic, don't we? Someone's got to keep the ancient traditions alive.
Rami's family bid him farewell at the docks. He hadn't packed much. He would outgrow any clothes he brought in half a year. His mother clasped the sides of his face and kissed him on the forehead. Make sure to write. Once a month, no, once a week. And make sure to pray. Yes, Amma. His sisters clung to his jacket.
Will you send presents?
They asked.
Will you meet the king?
Yes, he said. And no, I don't care to. His father stood a little way back, observing his wife and children, blinking hard as if trying to commit everything to memory. At last, when the boarding call sounded, he hugged his son to his chest and whispered, Allah Hafiz.
Goodbye. May God be your protector.
Write to your mother. Yes, Abu. Forget not who you are, Ramiz. Yes, Abu.
Rami was 14 then, and old enough to understand the meaning of pride. Rami intended to do more than remember, for he understood now why his father had smiled that day in the sitting room. Not out of weakness or submission, and not out of fear of reprisal. He'd been playing a part. He'd been showing Rami how it was done. Lie, Ramiz. This was the lesson. The most important lesson he'd ever been taught. Hide, Ramiz. Show the world what they want. Contort yourself into the image they want to see. Because seizing control of the story is how you in turn control them. Hide your faith. Hide your prayers. For Allah will still know your heart. And what an act Rami put on. He had no trouble navigating English high society. Calcutta had its fair share of English taverns, music halls and theatres, and what he saw in Yorkshire was no more than an expansion of the elite microcosm he'd grown up in. He thickened and thinned his accent depending on his audience. He learned all the fanciful notions the English held about his people, elaborated on them like an expert playwright, and spat them back out. He knew when to play a lascar, a houseboy, a prince. He learned when to flatter, and when to engage in self-deprecation. He could have written a thesis on white pride, on white curiosity. He knew how to make himself an object of fascination while neutralizing himself as a threat. He fine-tuned the greatest of all tricks, which was to swindle an Englishman into looking at him with respect. He grew so good at this that he almost began to lose himself in the artifice. A dangerous trap indeed for a player to believe his own stories, to be blinded by the applause. He could envision himself as a postgraduate fellow, dripping with distinctions and awards, a richly paid solicitor on legal, a highly acclaimed spontaneous interpreter, sailing back and forth between London and Calcutta, bringing riches and gifts for his family every time he returned. And this scared him sometimes, how easily he danced around Oxford, how attainable this imagined future seemed. Outside, he dazzled. Inside, he felt like a fraud, a traitor. And he was just starting to despair, to wonder if all he would ever accomplish was to become a lackey of empire as Wilson had intended. For the avenues of anti-colonial resistance seemed so few and so hopeless. Until his third year, when Anthony Ribbon appeared back from the dead and asked, "Will you join us?" And Rami, without hesitating, looked him in the eyes and said, "Yes."
Chapter 16. It appears quite certain that the Chinese, a money-making and money-loving people, are as much addicted to trade and as anxious as any nation on earth to court a commercial intercourse with strangers. John Crawford, Chinese Empire and Trade. Morning came. Robin rose, washed and dressed for class. He met Rami outside the house.
Neither said a word. They walked in silence to the tower door, which, despite Robin's sudden fear, opened to let them in. They were late. Professor Kraft was already lecturing when they took their seats. Letty shot them an irritated glare. Victoire gave Robin a nod, her face inscrutable. Professor Kraft continued as if she hadn't seen them. This was how she always dealt with tardiness. They pulled out their pens and began taking down notes on Tacitus and his thorny, ablative absolutes. The room seemed at once both mundane and heartbreakingly beautiful. The morning light streaming through stained glass windows, casting colourful patterns on the polished wooden desks, the clean scratch of chalk against the blackboard, and the sweet, woody smell of old books. A dream. This was an impossible dream, this fragile, lovely world in which, for the price of his convictions, he had been allowed to remain. That afternoon, they received notices in their pidgeys to prepare to depart for Canton by way of London by the 11th of October, the day after next. They would spend 3 weeks in China, 2 in Canton, and 1 in Macau, and then stop in Mauritius for 10 days on the way home. "Your destinations are temperate, but the sea voyage can be chilly," read the notice. "Bring a thick coat."
"Isn't this a bit early?"
asked Letty. "I thought we weren't going until after our exams." "It explains here," Rami tapped the bottom of the page. "Special circumstances in Canton. They're short on Chinese translators and want babblers to fill in the gap. So they've pushed our voyage up ahead."
"Well, that's exciting,"
Letty beamed. "It'll be our first chance to go out in the world and do something." Robin, Rami and Victoire exchanged glances with one another. They all shared the same suspicion, that their sudden departure was somehow linked to Friday night. But they couldn't know what that meant for Rami's and Victoire's presumed innocence, or what this voyage held in store for them all. The final day before they left was torture. The only one among them who felt any excitement was Letty, who took it upon herself to march into their rooms that night and make sure their trunks were properly packed. "You don't realise how cold it gets at sea in the mornings," she said, folding Rami's shirts into a neat pile on his bed. "You'll need more than just a linen shirt, Rami. You'll want 2 layers at least."
"Please, Letitia."
Rami swatted her hand away before she could get at his socks. "We've all been at sea before."
"Well, I've travelled regularly," she said, ignoring him. "I ought to know. And we should keep a little bag of remedies. Sleeping tinctures, ginger. I'm not sure there's time to run to a shop. We might have to do so in London."
"It's a long time on a little ship," snapped Rami. "It's not the Crusades."
Letty turned stiffly to sort through Robin's trunk. Victoire cast Robin and Rami a helpless look. They couldn't speak freely in Letty's presence, so they could only sit simmering in anxiety. The same unanswered questions bedeviled them all. What was happening? Had they been forgiven? Or was the axe still waiting to drop? Would they naively board the ship to Canton, only to be abandoned on the other side? Most importantly, how was it possible they'd been recruited separately to the Hermes Society without knowledge of the others? Rami and Victoire at least had some excuse. They were new to Hermes. They might have been too frightened by the Society's demands for silence to say anything to Robin yet. But Robin had known about Hermes for 3 years now, and he'd never spoken of it once, not even to Rami. He'd done a marvellous job hiding his greatest secret from friends who, he'd proclaimed, owned his heart. This, Robin suspected, had greatly rattled Rami. After they'd walked the girls north to their lodgings that night, Robin tried to broach the subject, but Rami shook his head.
"Not now, Birdie."
Robin's heart ached.
"But I only wanted to explain."
"Then I think we ought to wait for Victoire," Rami said curtly. "Don't you?" They headed to London the next afternoon with Professor Lovell, who was to be their supervisor throughout the voyage. The trip was, thankfully, much shorter than the 10-hour stagecoach ride that had brought Robin to Oxford 3 years ago. The railway line between Oxford and Paddington Station had finally been completed over the previous summer, its opening commemorated with the installation of silver bars under the platform of a newly constructed Oxford station. And so the journey took them only an hour and a half, during which Robin managed not to meet Professor Lovell's eyes once.
The proliferation of Britain's railways had happened very quickly after the invention of silver-powered steam engines. The 35-mile Liverpool to Manchester line, built in 1830, was the first railway built for general use, and nearly 7,000 miles of track had been laid around England since. The line from Oxford to London would have been built much sooner, but Oxford's professors delayed it for nearly 4 years, on the grounds that such easy access to the temptations of the capital would wreak moral havoc on the young, naive gentlemen left in their care. And because of the noise.
Their ship did not depart until tomorrow. They would lodge overnight at an inn on New Bond Street. Letty insisted they go out and explore London for a bit, so they ended up going to see the sitting room show of someone who called herself Princess Caribou. Princess Caribou was notorious among Babel students. Once a humble cobbler's daughter, she had persuaded several people into believing she was exotic royalty from the island of Javasu. But it was now nearly a decade since Princess Caribou had been unmasked as Mary Wilcox of North Devon, and her show, which consisted of a strange hopping dance, several very emphatic utterances in a made-up tongue, and prayers to a god she called Alatala. Here, Rami wrinkled his nose, came off as more pathetic than funny. The display put a bad taste in their mouths. They left early and returned to the inn, tired and laconic. The next morning, they boarded an East India Company clipper named the Merope, heading straight for Canton. These ships were built for speed, for they had to ferry perishable goods back and forth as quickly as possible, and were thus fitted out with state-of-the-art silver bars to hasten their voyage. Robin vaguely remembered that his first journey from Canton to London, 10 years ago, had taken close to 4 months. These clippers could make that journey a mere 6 weeks.
Excited? Letty asked him, as the Merope made its way out from the port of London over the Thames towards open water.
Robin wasn't sure. He'd felt funny ever since they'd boarded, though he couldn't quite give a name to his discomfort. It didn't seem real that he was headed back. 10 years ago, he'd been thrilled as he sailed towards London, head spinning with dreams of the world on the other side of the ocean. This time, he thought he knew what to expect. That scared him. He imagined his homecoming with a dreadful anticipation, the fear of not knowing one's own mother in a crowd. Would he recognize what he saw? Would he remember it at all? At the same time, the prospect of seeing Canton again seemed so sudden and unbelievable, he found himself with a strange conviction that by the time they reached it, it would have disappeared clean off the globe. Still more frightening was the possibility that once he arrived, he'd be made to stay, that Lovell had lied and his whole trip was contrived to get him out of England, that he would be exiled from Oxford and all that he knew forever. Meanwhile, there were 6 weeks at sea to suffer through. These proved torturous from the start. Rami and Victoire were like dead men walking, pale-faced and jumpy, flinching at the slightest noises, and unable to engage in the simplest small talk without assuming expressions of utter terror. Neither of them had been punished by the university. Neither of them had even been called in for questioning. But surely, Robin thought, Professor Lovell at least suspected their involvement. The guilt was written all over their faces. How much, then, did Babel know? How much did Hermes know? And what had happened to Griffin's safe room? Robin wanted nothing more than to discuss things with Rami and Victoire, but they never had the opportunity. Letty was always there. Even at night, when they retreated into their separate cabins, there was no chance that Victoire could sneak away to join the boys without Letty growing suspicious. They had no choice but to pretend everything was normal, but they were dreadful at this. They were all clammy, fidgety and irritable. None of them could drum up enthusiasm for what ought to have been the most exciting chapter of their careers. And they couldn't make conversation about anything else. None of their old jokes or inconsequential debates came easily to mind, and whenever they did, they sounded heavy and forced. Letty, pushy, chatty and oblivious, was grating on them all. And though they tried to conceal their irritation, for it wasn't her fault, they couldn't help snapping at her when she asked their thoughts on Cantonese cuisine for the dozenth time. Finally, she caught wind that something was going on. 3 nights in, after Professor Lovell had departed the mess, she slammed down her fork at dinner and demanded, "What is wrong with everyone?" Rami gave her a wooden stare. "I don't know what you mean."
"Don't pretend," Letty snapped. "You're all acting bizarre. You won't touch your food. You're mangling your lessons. I don't think you've even touched your phrasebook, Rami. Which is funny, because you've been saying for months that you bet you could imitate a better Chinese accent than Robin."
"We are seasick," Victoire blurted. "All right? Not all of us grew up summering up and down the Mediterranean like you."
"And I suppose you were seasick in London too?"
Letty asked archly.
"No, just tired of your voice," Rami said viciously.
Letty reeled. Robin pushed his chair back and stood.
"I need air."
Victoire called after him, but he pretended not to hear. He felt guilty abandoning her and Rami to Letty for fleeing the catastrophic fallout, but he couldn't bear to be at that table for another moment. He felt very hot and agitated, as if 1,000 ants were crawling around under his clothes. If he didn't get away, walk around, move, then he was sure he would explode. Outside, it was cold and quickly turning dark. The deck was empty, except for Professor Lovell, who was having a smoke by the prow. Robin almost turned back around when he saw him. They had not uttered a word to each other except for pleasantries since the morning after he'd been caught. But Professor Lovell had already seen him. He lowered his pipe and beckoned Robin to join him. Heart pounding, Robin approached.
"I remember the last time you made this voyage," Professor Lovell nodded at the black, rolling waves. "You were so small."
Robin didn't know how to respond, so he merely stared at him, waiting for him to continue. To his great surprise, Professor Lovell reached out then and placed a hand on Robin's shoulder. But the touch felt awkward, forced, the angles off, the pressure too heavy. They stood, strained and baffled, like two actors before a daguerreotype, holding their positions just until the light flashed.
"I believe in fresh starts," said Professor Lovell.
He seemed to have rehearsed these words. They came out as stilted and awkward as his touch.
"What I mean to say, Robin, is that you're very talented. We'd be sorry to lose you."
"Thank you,"
was all Robin said, for he still had no idea where this was going. Professor Lovell cleared his throat, then waved his pipe around a bit before he spoke, as if coaxing his own words out of his chest.
"Anyhow, what I really wish to say is, which I perhaps ought to have said before, I can understand if you were feeling disappointed by me."
Robin blinked. "Sir?"
"I should have been more sympathetic to your situation."
Professor Lovell glanced back out at the ocean. He seemed to have trouble looking Robin in the eye and speaking at the same time.
"Growing up outside your country, leaving everything you knew behind, adapting to a new environment where I'm sure you received, well, less than the amount of care and affection you likely needed. Those were all things that affected Griffin as well, and I can't say I've handled things better the second time. You are responsible for your own poor decisions, but I confess I do in part blame myself."
He cleared his throat again.
"I'd like for us to start anew, a clean slate for you, a renewed commitment on my part to be a better guardian. We'll pretend the past few days never happened. We'll put the Hermes Society and Griffin behind us. We'll think only of the future and all the glorious and brilliant things you will achieve at Babel. Is that fair?"
Robin was momentarily struck dumb. To be honest, this was not a very large concession. Professor Lovell had only apologized for being, occasionally, somewhat distant. He hadn't apologized for refusing to claim Robin as a son. He hadn't apologized for letting his mother die. Still, he'd made a greater acknowledgement of Robin's feelings than he'd ever done. And for the first time since they'd boarded the Merope, Robin felt that he could breathe.
"Yes, sir,"
Robin murmured, for there was nothing else to say.
"Very good, then,"
Professor Lovell patted him on the shoulder, a gesture so awkward that Robin cringed and headed past him for the stairs.
Good night.
Robin turned back to the waves. He took another breath and closed his eyes, trying to imagine how he might feel if he really could erase the past week. He'd be exhilarated, wouldn't he? He'd be gazing over the horizon, hurtling into the future he'd been training for. And what an exciting future. A successful Canton trip, a grueling fourth year, and then graduation into a post at the Foreign Office, or a fellowship in the Tower. Repeat voyages to Canton, Macau, and Peking, a long and glorious career translating on behalf of the Crown. There were so very few qualified sinologists in England. He could be so many firsts. He could chart so much territory. Shouldn't he want it? Shouldn't that thrill him? He could still have it. That was what Professor Lovell had been trying to tell him, that history was malleable, that all that mattered were decisions of the present, that they could bury Griffin and the Hermes Society into the recesses of the untouched past. He wouldn't even need to betray them. Simply ignore them, just like they'd buried everything else they'd agreed was better left unmentioned. Robin opened his eyes, stared out over the rolling waves until he lost focus, until he was staring at nothing at all, and tried to convince himself that if he was not happy, he was at least content. It was a week into the voyage before Robin, Rami, and Victoire had a private moment to themselves. Halfway through their morning stroll, Letty went back below deck, claiming an upset stomach. Victoire offered half-heartedly to go with her, but Letty waved her off. She was still annoyed with them all, and clearly wanted to be alone. All right. Victoire stepped closer to Robin and Rami as soon as Letty had gone, closing off the gap made by her absence so that the three of them stood tight, an impenetrable silo against the wind. What in God's name? They all started talking at once. Why didn't... Do you think Lovell... When did you first... They fell silent. Victoire tried again. So who recruited you? She asked Robin. It wouldn't have been Anthony. He would have told us. But isn't Anthony... No, he's very much alive, said Rami. Faked his death abroad. But answer the question, Birdie. Griffin, Robin said, still reeling from this revelation. I told you, Griffin Lovell. Who's that? Victoire asked, at the same time that Rami said, Lovell? A former Babel student. I think he's also, he said he's my half-brother. He looks just like me. We think Lovell, our father. Robin was tripping over his words. The Chinese character,
Bu,
meant both cloth and to relate, to tell. The truth was embroidered on a cloth tapestry, spread out to display its contents. But Robin, coming clean to his friends at last, had no idea where to start. The image he displayed was a jumbled and confused one, warped no matter how he told it by its complexity. He left Babel several years ago and then went underground right around Evie Brooke's... I think he killed Evie Brooke.
Good heavens,
Victoire said.
Really? Why?
Because... She caught him on Hermes business, said Robin. I didn't know until Professor Lovell told me. And you believe him? Asked Rami. Yes, said Robin. Yes, I think Griffin would. Griffin is absolutely the kind of person who would have... He shook his head. Listen, the important thing is that Lovell thinks I was acting alone. Has he talked to either one of you? Not me, said Victoire.
Nor I, said Rami. No one's approached us at all.
That's good, Robin exclaimed, isn't it?
There was an awkward silence. Rami and Victoire did not look half as relieved as Robin expected.
That's good,
Rami said finally.
That's all you've got to say?
What do you mean? Asked Robin.
What do you think I mean? Demanded Rami. Don't avoid the subject. How long were you with Hermes?
There was nothing to do but be honest. Since I started here? Since the very first week?
Are you joking?
Victoire touched his arm.
Rami, don't tell me that doesn't infuriate you, Rami snapped at her. That's 3 years. 3 years he never told us what he was up to.
Hold on, said Robin. Are you angry with me? Very good, Birdie, you noticed. I don't understand. Rami, what did I do wrong?
Victoire sighed and glanced out over the water. Rami gave him a hard glare and then burst out.
Why didn't you just ask me?
Robin was stunned by his vehemence.
Are you serious? You've known Griffin for years, said Rami. Years, and you never thought to tell us about it? You never thought we might like to join up as well?
Robin could not believe how unfair this was.
But you never told me. I wanted to, said Rami. We were going to, said Victoire. We begged Anthony. We almost let it slip so many times. He kept telling us not to, but we decided we would break it to you ourselves. We were going to do it that Sunday.
But you didn't even ask, Griffin, did you? Rami demanded.
3 years. Lord, Birdie. I was trying to protect you, Robin said helplessly.
Rami scoffed.
From what? Precisely the community we wanted? I didn't want to put you at risk. Why didn't you let me decide that for myself? Because I knew you'd say yes, Robin said. Because you join up with them on the spot and abdicate everything at Babel. Everything you've worked for. Everything I've worked for is this, Rami exclaimed. What? You think I came to Babel because I want to be a translator for the Queen? Birdie, I hate it in this country. I hate the way they look at me. I hate being passed around at their wine parties like an animal on display. I hate knowing that my very presence at Oxford is a betrayal of my race and religion because I'm becoming just that class of person Macaulay hoped to create. I've been waiting for an opportunity like Hermes since I got here.
But that's just it, said Robin. That's precisely why it was too risky for you. And it's not for you.
No,
Robin said, suddenly angry.
It wasn't.
He didn't have to say why. Robin, whose father was on the faculty, who could pass for white under the right lighting, at the right angles, was shielded in a way Rami and Victoire were not. If Rami or Victoire had faced the police that night, they wouldn't have been on this ship. They would have been behind bars, or worse. Rami's throat pulsed.
Damn it, Robin.
I'm sure it wasn't easy, Victoire said, trying valiantly to broker a peace.
They're so strict with their secrecy, you remember.
Yes, but we know each other.
Rami shot Robin a glare.
Or at least I thought we did.
Hermes is messy,
Robin insisted.
They've ignored my warnings. They hang their members out to dry. And it wouldn't have done you any good to be sent down your first year. I would have been careful,
Rami scoffed.
I'm not like you. I'm not scared of my own shadow.
But you're not careful,
Robin said, exasperated. So they were trading insults now. So they were being frank now.
You were caught, weren't you? You're impulsive. You don't think. The moment anyone insults your pride, you lash out. Then what about Victoire?
Victoire's...
Robin trailed off. He had no defense. He hadn't told Victoire about Hermes because he'd assumed she had too much to lose. But there was no good way to say this out loud or to justify its logic. She knew what he meant. She would not meet his pleading look.
Thank God for Anthony, was all she said. I've just one more question,
Rami said abruptly. He was really, truly furious, Robin realized. This was not merely a burst of Rami-esque passion. This was something they perhaps could not come back from.
What did you say to make it go away? What did you give up?
Robin couldn't lie to Rami's face. He wanted to. He was so afraid of the truth and of the way Rami would look at him when he heard it. But this he could not hide. It would rip him apart.
He wanted information.
And so?
So I gave him information.
Victoire touched a hand to her mouth.
Everything?
Just what I knew, Robin said, which wasn't much. Griffin made sure of it. I never even knew what he did with the books I took out for him. All I told Lovell about was one safe room at St. Aldate's. It didn't help. She still looked at him as if he kicked a puppy.
Are you mad?
Rami asked.
It didn't matter,
Robin insisted.
Griffin's never there. He told me himself. And I bet they haven't even caught him. He's so incredibly paranoid. I bet he's already out of the country by now. Rami shook his head in amazement.
But you still betrayed them.
This was profoundly unfair, Robin thought. He'd saved them. He'd done the only thing he could think of to minimize the damage, which was more than Hermes had ever done for him. Why was he now under siege?
I was only trying to save you.
Rami was unmoved.
You were saving yourself. Look, Robin snapped. I don't have a family. I have a contract, a guardian, and a house in Canton full of dead relatives that, for all I know, could still be rotting in their beds. That's what I'm sailing home to. You have Calcutta. Without Babel, I have nothing.
Rami crossed his arms and set his jaw. Victoire cast Robin a sympathetic look, but said nothing in his defense.
I'm not a traitor, Robin pleaded. I'm just trying to survive.
Survival's not that difficult, Birdie. Rami's eyes were very hard. But you've got to maintain some dignity while you're at it. The rest of the voyage was decidedly miserable. Rami, it seemed, had said all he wanted to say. He and Robin passed all the hours they spent in their shared cabin in desperately uncomfortable silence. Mealtimes weren't much better. Victoire was polite but distant. There was little she could say in Letty's presence, and she didn't make much effort to seek Robin out otherwise. And Letty was still angry with all of them, which made small talk nigh impossible. Things would have been better if they had had a single other soul for company, but they were the only passengers on a trade ship where the sailors seemed interested in anything but befriending Oxford scholars, whom they considered an unwanted and ill-timed burden. Robin spent most of his days either alone above deck or alone in his cabin. Under any other circumstances, the voyage would have been a fascinating chance to examine the unique linguistics of nautical environments, which blended the necessary multilingualism brought about by foreign crews in foreign destinations with the highly technical vocabulary of seacraft. What was a banyande? What was marling? Was the anchor attached to the better end or the bitter end? Normally, he would have delighted in finding out. But he was busy sulking, still both baffled and resentful at how he'd lost his friends in the process of trying to save them. Letty, poor thing, was the most confused of all. The rest of them at least understood the cause for the hostilities. Letty hadn't a clue what was going on. She was the only innocent here, unfairly caught in the crossfire. All she knew was that things were wrong and sour, and she was driving herself up the wall trying to figure out what the reason was. Someone else might have grown withdrawn and sullen, resentful at being shut out by their closest friends. But Letty was as pig-headed as ever, determined to resolve problems through brute force. When none of them would give her a concrete answer to the question, "What's happened?" she decided to try conquering them one by one, to pry out their secrets through over-solicitous kindness. But this had the opposite of her intended effect. Rami began leaving the room every time she came in. Victoire, who, as Letty's roommate, could not escape her, started showing up at breakfast looking haggard and exasperated. When Letty asked her for the salt, Victoire snapped so viciously at her to get it herself that Letty reeled back, wounded. Undaunted, she began broaching startlingly personal topics every time she was alone with one of them, like a dentist prodding teeth to see where it hurt most, to find what needed fixing.
"It can't be easy," she said to Robin one day.
"You and him?"
Robin, who thought at first she was talking about Rami, stiffened.
How do you mean?" "It's just so obvious," she said. "I mean, you look so much like him. Everyone can see it. It's not like anyone suspects otherwise."
She meant Professor Lovell, Robin realized, not Rami. He was so relieved that he found himself engaging in the conversation.
"It's a strange arrangement," he admitted.
"Only I've grown so used to it that I've stopped wondering why it isn't otherwise."
"Why won't he publicly acknowledge you?" she asked. "Is it because of his family, do you think? The wife?"
"Perhaps," he said.
"But I'm really not bothered. I wouldn't know what to do if he did declare himself my father, to be honest. I'm not sure I want to be a Lovell."
"But doesn't it kill you?"
"Why would it?"
"Well, my father..."
she started, then broke off and coughed primly. I mean, you all know. My father won't speak to me, hasn't looked me in the eyes and spoken to me after Lincoln, and I just wanted to say, I know a bit what it's like, that's all. I'm sorry, Letty. He patted her hand and immediately felt guilty for doing it. It seemed so fake. But she took the gesture at face value. She, too, must have been starved for familiar contact, for some indication that her friends still liked her. And I just wanted to say, I'm here for you. She took his hand in hers. I hope this isn't too forward, but it's just that I've noticed he's not treating you the same, not the way he used to. He won't look you in the eyes and he won't speak to you directly. And I don't know what happened, but it's not right. And it's very unfair what he's done to you. And I want you to know that if you want to talk, Birdie, I'm here. She never called him Birdie. That's Rami's word, Robin almost uttered, before realizing that would be the absolute worst thing to say. He tried to remind himself to be kind. She was, after all, only attempting her version of comfort. Letty was bullheaded and overbearing, but she did care. Thank you. He gave her fingers a squeeze, hoping that if he did not elaborate, then this might force the end of the conversation. I appreciate that. At least there was work to distract. Babel's practice of sending entire cohorts, all of whom specialized in different languages, on the same graduation voyages was a testament to the reach and connectedness of the British trading companies. The colonial trade had its claws in dozens of countries across the world, and its labour, consumers and producers spoke scores of tongues. During the voyage, Rami was often asked to translate for the Urdu and Bengali-speaking Lascars, never mind that his Bengali was now rudimentary at best. Letty and Victoire were put to work looking over shipping manifests for their next leg to Mauritius, and translating stolen correspondences from French missionaries and French trading companies out of China. The Napoleonic Wars had ended, but the competition for empire had not. Every afternoon, Professor Lovell tutored Rami, Letty, and Victoire in Mandarin from 2 to 5. No one expected they would be fluent by the time they docked in Canton, but the point was to force-feed them enough vocabulary that they would understand basic salutations, directions, and common nouns. There was also, Professor Lovell argued, a great pedagogical benefit to learning a wholly new language in a very short amount of time. It forced the mind to stretch and build rapid connections, to contrast unfamiliar language structures with what one already knew. Chinese is awful, Victoire complained to Robin one night after class. There are no conjugations, no tenses, no declensions. How do you ever know the meaning of a sentence? And don't get me started on tones. I simply can't hear them. Perhaps I'm just not very musical, but I really can't tell the difference. I'm starting to think they're a hoax. It doesn't matter, Robin assured her. He was mostly glad she was talking to him at all. After 3 weeks, Rami had finally deigned to exchange basic civilities, but Victoire, though she still held him at arm's length, had forgiven him enough to speak to him like a friend. They don't speak Mandarin in Canton anyway. You'd need Cantonese to actually get around. And Lovell doesn't speak it? No, Robin said. No, that's why he needs me. In the evenings, Professor Lovell primed them for the purpose of their mission in Canton. They were going to help negotiate on behalf of several private trading companies, foremost among them Jardine, Matheson and Company. This would be more difficult than it sounded, for trade relations with the Qing court had been marked by mutual misunderstanding and suspicion since the end of the past century. The Chinese, wary of foreign influences, preferred to keep the British contained with other foreign traders at Canton and Macau. But British merchants wanted free trade, open ports, market access past the islands, and the lifting of restrictions on particular imports such as opium. The three previous attempts by the British to negotiate broader trading rights had ended in abject failure. In 1793, the Macartney Embassy became a global punchline when Lord George Macartney refused to kowtow to the Qianlong Emperor and came away with nothing. The Amherst Embassy of 1816 went very much the same way when Lord William Amherst similarly refused to kowtow to the Jiang Qing Emperor
and was subsequently refused admission to Peking at all. There was also, of course, the disastrous Napier affair of 1834, which climaxed in a pointless exchange of cannon fire and Lord William Napier's ignoble death of fever in Macau. Theirs would be the fourth such delegation.
It'll be different this time, vowed Professor Lovell, because at last they've called on Babel translators to lead the talks, no more fiascos of cultural miscommunication.
Have they not consulted you before? Letty asked. That's quite amazing.
You'd be surprised how often traders think they shouldn't need our help, said Professor Lovell. They tend to assume everyone should naturally just learn to speak and behave like the English. They've done a fairly good job at provoking local animosity with that attitude, if the Canton papers aren't exaggerating. Expect some less than friendly natives.
They all had a good idea the kind of tension they would see in China. They'd read more and more coverage of Canton in London's newspapers of late, which mostly reported the kinds of ignominies British merchants were suffering at the hands of brutal local barbarians. Chinese forces, according to the Times, were intimidating merchants, attempting to expel them from their homes and factories, and publishing insulting things about them in their own press. Professor Lovell opined strongly that, though the traders could have been more delicate, such heightened tensions were fundamentally the fault of the Chinese.
The problem is that the Chinese have convinced themselves that they're the most superior nation in the world, he said. They insist on using the word Yi to describe Europeans in their official memos, though we've asked them time and time again to use something more respectful, as Yi is a designation for barbarians. And they take this attitude into all trade and legal negotiations. They recognize no laws except their own, and they don't regard foreign trade as an opportunity, but as a pesky incursion to be dealt with.
You'd be in favor of violence, then? Letty asked.
It might be the best thing for them, said Professor Lovell with surprising vehemence. It'd do well to teach them a lesson. China is a nation of semi-barbarous people in the grips of backward Manchu rulers, and it would do them good to be forcibly open to commercial enterprise and progress. No, I wouldn't oppose a bit of a shake-up. Sometimes a crying child must be spanked.
Here, Rami glanced sideways at Robin, who looked away. What more was there to say? 6 weeks at last came to an end. Professor Lovell informed them at dinner one night that they could expect to dock at Canton by noon the next day. Prior to disembarking, Victoire and Letty were requested to bind their chests and to clip their hair, which they'd grown long during their years as upperclassmen above their ears.
The Chinese are strict about barring foreign women in Canton, explained Professor Lovell. They don't like it when traders bring their families in. It makes it seem like they're here to stay.
Surely they don't actually enforce that, protested Letty. What about the wives and the maidservants?
The expats here hire local servants and they keep their wives in Macau. They're quite serious about enforcing these laws. The last time a British man tried to bring his wife to Canton, William Baines, I believe it was, the local authorities threatened to send in soldiers to remove her.
Baines ended up placing a cannon in front of the English factory to keep the Chinese from seizing his wife, and it was all very exciting for a fortnight, until the lady was at last peaceably persuaded to leave.
Anyhow, it's for your own benefit. The Chinese treat women very badly. They have no conception of chivalry. They hold their women in low esteem, and in some cases don't even permit them to leave the house. You'll be better off if they think you're young men. You'll learn that Chinese society remains quite backwards and unjust.
I wonder what that's like, Victoire said dryly, accepting the cap. The next morning, they spent the sunrise hour above deck, milling about the prow, occasionally leaning over the railing as if those inches of difference would help them spot what navigational science claimed they were fast approaching. The thick dawn mists had just given way to blue sky when the horizon revealed a thin strip of green and grey. Slowly this acquired detail, like a dream materialising. The blurred colours became a coast, became a silhouette of buildings behind a mass of ships docking at the tiny point where the Middle Kingdom encountered the world. For the first time in a decade, Robin found himself gazing at the shores of his motherland.
What are you thinking? Rami asked him quietly. This was the first time they'd spoken directly to each other in weeks. It was not a truce. Rami still refused to look him in the eyes. But it was an opening, a grudging acknowledgement that despite everything, Rami still cared. And for that, Robin was grateful. I'm thinking about the Chinese character for Dawn, he said truthfully. He couldn't let himself dwell on the larger magnitude of it all. His thoughts threatened to spiral to places he feared he could not control unless he brought them down to the familiar distraction of language. Dan, it looks like this. He drew the character in the air. Dan. Up top is the radical for the sun. Ri. He drew Ri. And under that, a line. And I'm just thinking about how it's beautiful because it's so simple. It's the most direct use of pictography, see? Because dawn is just the sun coming up over the horizon. Chapter 17. Quecarit ora cruore nostro? What coast knows not our blood? Horace, Odes. A year ago, after overhearing Colin and the Sharp brothers loudly discussing it in the common room, Robin had gone alone to London over a weekend to see the celebrated Ah Fong Moy. Advertised as the Chinese lady, Ah Fong Moy had been brought out of China by a pair of American traders who initially hoped to use an Oriental lady to showcase goods acquired overseas, but who quickly realized they could, instead, make a fortune exhibiting her person across the eastern seaboard. This was her first tour to England. Robin had read somewhere that she was also from Canton. He wasn't sure what he'd hoped for other than a glimpse of, perhaps a moment of connection with, someone who shared his motherland. His ticket granted him admission to a garish stage room advertised as a Chinese saloon, decorated with randomly placed ceramics, shoddy imitations of Chinese paintings, and a suffocating quantity of gold and red damask illuminated by cheap paper lanterns. The Chinese lady herself was seated on a chair at the front of the room. She wore a blue silk button shirt, and her feet, bound conspicuously in linen, were propped up on a small cushion before her. She looked very small. The pamphlet he'd been handed at the ticket booth claimed she was somewhere in her 20s, but she could have easily been as young as 12. The room was loud and packed with an audience of mostly men. They hushed when, slowly, she reached down to unbind her feet. The story of her feet was also explained in the pamphlet. Like many young Chinese women, Ah Fong Moy's feet had been broken and bound when she was young to restrict their growth and to leave them curved in an unnatural arch that gave her a tottering, unstable gait. As she walked across the stage, the men around Robin pushed forward, trying to get a closer look, but Robin could not understand the appeal. The sight of her feet seemed neither erotic nor fascinating, but rather a great invasion of intimacy. Standing there, watching her, he felt as embarrassed as if she'd just pulled down her trousers before him. Ah Fong Moy returned to her chair. Her eyes locked suddenly on Robin's. She seemed to have scanned the room and found kinship in his face. Cheeks flushing, he averted his eyes. When she started to sing, a lilting, haunting melody that he did not recognize and could not understand, he pushed his way through the crowd and left the room. Apart from Griffin, he had not seen any Chinese people since. As they sailed inland, he noticed that Letty kept looking at his face, then at the dockworkers' faces as if comparing them. Perhaps she was trying to determine precisely how Chinese he looked, or to see if he was experiencing some great emotional catharsis. But nothing stirred in his chest. Standing on the deck, minutes from stepping foot on his motherland after a lifetime away, all Robin felt was empty. They made anchor and disembarked at Whampoa, where they boarded smaller boats to continue up Canton's riverfront. Here the city became a wash of noise, of the ongoing rumbling and humming of gongs, firecrackers, and shouting boatmen moving their craft up and down the river. It was unbearably loud. Robin did not remember such a din from his childhood. Either Canton had grown much busier,
or his ears had grown unaccustomed to its sounds. They stepped ashore at Jackass Point, where they were met by Mr. Bayliss, their liaison with Jardine, Matheson & Co. Mr. Bayliss was a short, well-dressed man with dark, clever eyes who spoke with astonishing animation.
"You couldn't have arrived at a better time," he said, pumping Professor Lovell's hand,
then Robin's, and then Rami's, the girls he ignored.
"It's a disaster here. The Chinese are getting bolder and bolder by the day. They've broken up the distribution rings. They bombed one of the fast crabs to bits in the harbour just the other day. Thank God no one was on board. And the crackdowns will make trade impossible if this keeps up."
"What about the European smuggling boats?" asked Professor Lovell as they walked.
"That was a workaround, but only for a bit. Then the Viceroy started sending his people door to door in house searches. The whole city's terrified. You'll scare a man off just by mentioning the name of the drug. It's all the fault of that new Imperial Commissioner the Emperor sent down, Lin Zhezu. You'll meet him soon. He's the one we'll have to deal with."
Mr. Bayliss spoke so quickly as they walked that Robin was astonished he never ran out of breath.
"So he comes in and demands the immediate surrender of all opium brought to China. This was last March. Of course we said no. So he suspended trade and told us we're not to leave the factories until we're ready to play by the rules. Can you imagine? He put us under siege."
"A siege?" Professor Lovell repeated, looking mildly concerned.
"Oh, well, it really wasn't so bad. The Chinese staff went home, which was a trial. I had to do my own washing, and that was a disaster. But otherwise, we generally kept our spirits high. Really, the only harms were overfeeding and lack of exercise."
Mr. Bayliss gave a short, nasty laugh.
"Happily, that's over with, and now we can stroll around outside as we wish, no harm done. But there must be penalties, Richard. They've got to learn they can't get away with this. Ah, here we are, ladies and gents. Here is your home from home."
Past the southwestern suburbs, they came upon a row of 13 buildings in a line, all visibly Western in design, replete with recessed verandas, neoclassical ornaments, and European flags. These looked so jarring against the rest of Canton that it seemed as if some giant had dug up a neat strip of France or England and dropped it wholesale onto the city's edge. These were the factories, explained Mr. Bayliss, named not because they were centres of production, but because they were the residences of the factors, the agents of trade. Merchants, missionaries, government officials and soldiers lived here during trading season.
"Lovely, aren't they?" said Mr. Bayliss. "Quite like a handful of diamonds on top of a heap of old rubbish."
They were to stay at the new English factory. Mr. Bayliss led them quickly through the ground floor warehouse, past the social room and dining room, to the visiting chambers on the upper floors. There were also, he pointed out, a well-stocked library, several rooftop terraces, and even a garden facing the riverside.
"Now, they're very strict about keeping foreigners within the foreign enclave, so don't go exploring by yourselves," Mr. Bayliss warned. "Stay within the factories. There's a corner in the Imperial Factory, that's number 3, where Markwick and Lane sell all sorts of European goods you might need, though they haven't got many books apart from nautical charts. Those flower boats are strictly off limits, do you hear me? Our merchant friends can arrange for some women of a more discreet temperament to visit in the evenings if you need some company. No?"
Rami's ears had gone bright red.
"We'll be fine, sir." Mr. Bayliss chuckled. "Suit yourself. You'll be staying just down this hall."
Robin and Rami's room was quite gloomy. The walls, which must have originally been painted dark green, were now nearly black. The girls' room was as dark and considerably smaller. There was barely space to walk between the single bed and the wall. It also had no windows. Robin could not see how they were possibly expected to live there for 2 weeks.
"Technically, this is a storage unit, but we couldn't have you too close to the gentleman."
Mr. Bayliss at least made an effort to sound apologetic.
"You understand."
"Of course," Letty said, pushing her trunk into the room. "Thank you for your accommodations."
After putting down their things, they congregated in the dining room, which was furnished with one very large table capable of seating at least 25. Over the middle of the table was suspended an immense fan made of a cloth sail stretched over a wooden frame, which was kept in constant motion by a coolie servant who pulled and slackened it without pause throughout the dinner service. Robin found it quite distracting. He felt an odd pang of guilt every time he met the servant's eyes, but the other residents of the factory seemed to find the coolie invisible. Dinner that night was one of the most ghastly and uncomfortable affairs Robin had ever endured.